in the back room instead of the primaries, and by trying to label Kennedy ruthless because he is tough-minded and determined, or too young because he has energy and drive. This unholy alliance is playing right into Nixon's hands. The people want leadership, not labels, and they want Kennedy, not Humphrey. I called this into all my coordinators, Mary Jo told Smith. It is suggested that they use whichever one they felt best for their state, or not use any at all. Increasingly, newspaper accounts of the party at Chappaquiddick probed deeper into the accident. The assumption that drinking had taken place at the party, combined with a 10-hour delay in the report of the accident, made Smith anxious to gauge Edmund Denise's thinking. Smith was particularly concerned about a rule in the district attorney's office dealing with motor vehicle fatalities. Because drinking has a capacity to impair driving and has become the cause of 75% of fatal crashes, Denise had directed police chiefs in his district to charge with manslaughter all defendants accused of operating under the influence of liquor when such operation resulted in the death of another person. District court judges were to bind over to Superior Court all matters accompanying such complaints if probable cause was found. No complaint of driving under the influence was to be dismissed by a prosecutor or police officer, except by a judge. Assistants in the district attorney's office had reduced the policy to a formula called 3D, drunk driving plus death equals DA. Denise prosecuted such cases. When Smith called New Bedford on Sunday afternoon, he reached Denise's mother, with whom the bachelor district attorney lived. Mrs. Denise was praying for Rose Kennedy, she said. That poor woman. My heart goes out to her. She's been through so much. However, Mrs. Denise found the silence from the Kennedy compound about the accident puzzling. Why don't they just come out and tell the truth? To Smith, Mrs. Denise confided the results of a blood alcohol test, telephoned to her son by state police chemists in Boston. The results showed Mary Jo Kopechne had been drunk at the time of her death. The report escalated Smith's concern about the senator's possible liability in the case. He said later, "It was common knowledge that Teddy Kennedy had suffered a bad depression over what had happened to Bobby. Everybody was worried about his mental health." It was also common knowledge that Ted Kennedy was drinking more than it was wise for him to do on public occasions. Smith had worked himself into such a state of anxiety by the time Denise called him back. He launched a furious defense of Ted Kennedy's delay in reporting the accident even before the district attorney could say anything. "Don't forget, the guy got hit on the head. He's got a bad back, so he was in some pain. If he laid low for a while and said, 'My God, again,' meaning another disaster, put yourself in his place." Everyone in the United States had been affected by the deaths of John and Robert Kennedy, Smith said. "How would it be if they were both your brothers, and having your father upstairs not right? I just think the guy's been through so much." "I feel sorry for him," Denise said. He dismissed newspaper accounts, beginning to question gaps in the senator's report of the accident. "What's all this business about a conflicting statement? That's nothing. Never mind the press. Never mind being president. Let's save him." Denise outlined what would happen in the case. A complaint by Edgartown police would be issued on leaving the scene, and a trial scheduled at Kennedy's convenience. The registry inspector handling the case would file a report. More than likely, the registry would lift Ted's license for 6 months. Denise said, "It's a local matter anyway, a motor vehicles case." Denise didn't sound entirely convinced of that himself. He had more on his mind than expressing sympathy to a Kennedy partisan on his staff. "You get a hold of Ted Kennedy," Denise said. "You tell him I'm not going to prosecute him. I want to stay out of it." Denise had a message he wished Smith to deliver. "From me through you to Ted and nobody else," he said. "I won't touch this case unless Ted wants me to." Chapter 18. Smith had a list of telephone numbers for the compound. He dialed Ted Kennedy's house in Hyannisport. He said, "It's Jimmy Smith of Falmouth, a personal friend. I'm also assistant district attorney. I have something important to tell the senator." Smith was told Ted Kennedy was not available. "I impress upon you the importance of this call," Smith said. "It's urgent that I talk to Senator Kennedy." "He's not available," a male voice insisted, identifying himself as a member of the staff. Smith's temper flashed. "Do you have a name?" The telephone was abruptly clicked off. Smith was outraged. It was a real bang down. I thought, to hell with them. I never kissed a politician's ass in my life. Smith thought it over. In my heart, I wanted to help Ted Kennedy. And if Eddie Denise thought enough of me to ask that I deliver an important message, I wanted to make sure I did. Smith then called Kenneth O'Donnell, telling him of his conversation with Denise. Denise was understanding and concerned. His whole reaction to the accident was sympathetic, not hostile. Denise was not out to hurt Ted Kennedy. But as district attorney, he had an official duty to perform. He wanted the senator to know no dirty politics was going to be involved, because of the doubts there might be about him on account of his reputation for being a capricious wild man. If the fear of prosecution could be relieved in the minds of people at the compound giving the senator advice, it could change how the situation was being handled. Smith said, "Denise just wants Teddy Kennedy to know he has nothing to fear from him. That's all."
"Tell him," O'Donnell said cryptically.
"I just got off the phone. They won't let me talk to him," Smith said. "I can't get through to the guy."
"Stay here," O'Donnell ordered. "I'll get back to you." But Smith didn't hear from O'Donnell. Instead, he got a call from Ben Smith, John Kennedy's former Harvard roommate.
Named to fill the Senate seat vacated by Kennedy's election as president, Smith had relinquished the office in favor of Ted Kennedy's candidacy. "Ben's for the family," Ted said at the time. Long active in Kennedy campaigns, Ben Smith said, "Let's do all we can to help Teddy. Never mind Kenneth's attitude. He's waiting to be called. He's not volunteering." Jimmy Smith didn't have to be told O'Donnell had been too proud to call the compound, and asked Ben Smith to do it. And Ben Smith hadn't been able to get through either. Denise wanted his message delivered personally, didn't he? Ben Smith suggested, "Why don't you go over there?" "How can I drive to Hyannisport?" Smith protested. "The eyes of the world are trained on the place. I'm assistant district attorney. How would that look?" Ben Smith said, "You could park up by the golf club and walk over that way."
"Jesus, Ben. Can you just see me climbing the wall with 10 guys taking my picture?"
Ben Smith agreed that wasn't such a good idea. Neither Kenneth O'Donnell nor Ben Smith were going to clear the barriers keeping outsiders at bay, Smith realized. The people he had contacted were a different faction. The nuts and bolts campaign guys, the workers. Never mind the glamour stuff like the star volunteers, assembling at Hyannisport offering advice, Smith said. It was like the jealousy of the court, like the guys that protect the potentate. Nobody else was going to get a chance to help. You couldn't get through. Smith had one more high Irish connection to the Kennedy political apparatus left. A former Marine captain who'd won the Silver Star, John Nolan had given Smith his marching orders when he ran the scheduling for Jack Kennedy in 1960. Nolan held the same position for Robert Kennedy's presidential campaign. Nolan was out sailing when Smith called him in Maryland. Smith made no mention of the Denise message when Nolan called him back. "John was such a straight arrow. I was in awe of him. I would never want to put myself in a position where I was conveying any impropriety to him," Smith said. "I wasn't talking about a fix or anything like that. It was a situation where I wanted to be true to my job and help Teddy Kennedy, too." Smith had to talk to them over at the compound. How could he get through to these people? He knew Edgartown like the back of his hand. He knew all the people involved, he said. "I'm in a position where I can help with this thing." Nolan was reluctant to jump in. He thought Ken O'Donnell could handle it. "Kenneth's not in it," Smith said. "They're ignoring him. I don't think they know what they're doing over there. That's why I called you." "Somebody better talk to them. Somebody's got to alert them that it's way off track." The moon landing was taking a lot of attention away from the accident, but that isn't going to save him. Smith had despaired of penetrating the compound when he received a call from Burke Marshall.
Smith recognized. They had some kind of a brain trust going on over there, and they needed local information. Who were they going to call? They called me.
Marshall asked Smith to recommend a lawyer in Edgartown to represent Ted Kennedy. Smith ran down the list of attorneys on Martha's Vineyard. He recommended Dick McCarran. Smith had gone to law school with him.
While it was always a good idea to have a local lawyer defend a case on his home ground, Smith said, why go to trial?
The senator was only going to be charged with leaving the scene after causing personal injury.
That's no big deal. The insurance should cover any civil liability.
There were many options available.
Why don't you plead him? Smith said. Why don't you plead nolo?
How do you plead nolo? Marshall said.
Smith was astonished.
Maybe it was just a quick thing on his part, but that's what he said. How do you plead nolo?
Nolo contendere, I am willing to contend, or no contest, was a common plea in Massachusetts courtrooms. The advantage of the plea in a motor vehicles case was, you might not lose your license if there isn't a guilty finding, Smith said.
Clearly, Marshall had no idea how to defend the case.
Smith outlined the applicable motor vehicle statutes.
Arena had blown any driving to endanger or involuntary manslaughter charges by saying there was no evidence of negligence in the accident. You can't very well contradict the police officer in charge of the case.
Smith had tried to call Ted Kennedy personally, but hadn't been able to get through with a message from District Attorney Edmund Denise, he said.
Marshall cut him off. They would be in touch as soon as they reached a lawyer. They weren't going to deal directly with the district attorney's office.
Smith was stung.
This message was coming through loud and clear.
They didn't trust Denise. Not Teddy Kennedy, but the people around him.
Advisors at the compound were only adding layers between themselves and the situation. A serious miscalculation, in Smith's opinion.
The case was being handled by people who knew nothing about Massachusetts law or the local personalities involved. You didn't go over everybody's head on a thing like this. You had to deal with the case on the level it was on. Denise had a job to do. He was the guy you dealt with. You don't ignore him.
The lineup of big names reported at the compound giving advice made it look like a gang-up of special privilege. Inviting all those people to advise on a motor vehicle accident case made it look like Teddy Kennedy was in more serious trouble than he was, Smith said later.
The conferences at the compound were distorting the whole weight of the case. This was nothing that needed to be handled. Just a straightforward explanation of the accident was all that was needed.
Smith didn't know which attorney would be chosen to represent Ted Kennedy in Edgartown. He hoped his recommendation to retain Dick McCarran would be followed. McCarran was a solid bread-and-butter lawyer, knowledgeable in the local way of doing things. Maybe he'd be able to talk some sense into the counselors at the compound. The summons did come in a call to McCarran from Ed Hanafy around 8 o'clock on Sunday night. McCarran knew Hanafy by reputation. If the Supreme Court ever wanted to hear an important issue of law, McCarran said, Ed Hanafy is the kind of lawyer they would pick to argue it. For Hanafy to be in charge of defending Ted Kennedy in an automobile accident case was high-powered legal artillery. Slight and soft-spoken, McCarran referred to himself as a Boston Irish lawyer. He had moved to Edgartown in 1966. He agreed to represent Ted Kennedy on the charge of leaving the scene of an accident. McCarran went to work immediately, drawing up a petition for a hearing on the complaint application Arena was going to file the next morning in district court. A standard maneuver to discover what evidence police had about the accident, the petition gained time to prepare a case should the senator seek to defend the charge. Without a hearing, Kennedy could be arraigned within a few days. McCarran called Arena to let him know he was representing Ted Kennedy. McCarran knew and liked the police chief. They saw each other socially, he said. Our kids played together.
Arena was delighted a local lawyer had been retained.
At least now I've got somebody I can talk to, he said. Reporters were driving him nuts about the party at Chappaquiddick which had preceded the accident. I'm under terrific pressure from these press guys to do something about the party. That's all everybody's on my back about, that goddamn party, Arena complained. Jesus, Dick,
I ought to be able to get statements from some of these people. I ought to be able to talk to somebody who was there.
McCarran wasn't sure what he could do, having just taken the case. But he would try to see if he could line up somebody for Arena to talk to. Arena made the same request of George Killen.
I asked him if he could do me a favor and send somebody over to the compound to get statements from some of these people.
Arena wanted Killen to report any facts he might be able to pick up from Cape Cod people who had attended the party. Arena was in a bind.
Here I was, chief of a 5-man department, all guys who grew up on the island. They were supplemented by rent-a-cops you pinned a badge on and told to go out and be a policeman for the summer. I'm not belittling them, but I didn't have any sophisticated people. What am I going to do? Send one of my guys over to Hyannisport? The poor soul would get stuck at the gate. He wouldn't know where to go.
Arena was soliciting Killen's help as a fellow former state police officer. When you were a member of the alumni, as we like to think of it, you could call on these people to do things for you. Arena wasn't sure what Killen was going to do, he said. My impression was George was going to look into it. Arena settled back to watch a momentous television event. Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin Jr. opened the hatch of their depressurized landing vehicle, climbed down 9 rungs of a ladder to set foot on the moon, and pronounce, "One small step for man. One giant leap for mankind." Watching the epochal event with Arena was writer Brock Brower. The Life article on Ted Kennedy, which he had recently finished writing, had been bumped by the Apollo mission. Brower had then flown back to Martha's Vineyard to recast his piece in the light of the accident at Chappaquiddick, the result of pressures to run for president in 1972, which had helped push him to folly at Dyke Bridge. But Arena's attention wasn't fixed on the moonwalk. He was preoccupied by Senator Kennedy's failure to report the accident for some 10 hours. He told Brower, "Why didn't he call me? That's what I still can't understand. I mean, I couldn't have fixed it for him or anything like that, but it would have been so much better. For him. This way, I just don't understand. Why didn't he call?"
Chapter 19. Arena got to the police station early Monday morning to write his accident report. In it, he wrote that a car had been operated at an unknown rate of speed and been unable to stop upon entering Dyke Bridge. The accident had occurred between 12 midnight and 1 a.m., he said. "I was," Arena would confide later, leaning more in Huck Look's direction as to the time than I was Senator Kennedy's. Inspector George Kennedy, by contrast, put the time of the accident at about 11:20 p.m. in a report he filed with the Registry of Motor Vehicles on Monday morning. Preliminary investigation revealed operator lost control of car and was at fault in the accident. The report was immediately suppressed by registry officials. No decision could be made about releasing it to the public, a spokesman said, because Registrar Richard McLaughlin was at summer camp with the Air National Guard. The registry also received the findings of the medical examiner regarding an accident which had occurred at midnight. But Dr. Mills couldn't document his conclusion that Mary Jo Kopechne's death had occurred 6 hours or more from the time of his examination. He hadn't taken the body's temperature, nor attended to other routine procedures recommended by the Handbook for Medical Examiners, such as the removal of ocular fluid to test potassium content, in order for a reasonable time of death estimate to be made. Without an autopsy, it was not possible to do more than guess the time Mary Jo died, Mills said. I'm no pathologist. Hounded by reporters for the results of a state police lab test of Mary Jo Kopechne's blood alcohol content, Mills complained to District Attorney Edmund Denise on Monday morning that as a physician, he was used to keeping a patient's affairs secret. Mills found it repugnant to release the figure. "Keep it to yourself for a while and let's see what happens," Denise said, suggesting Mills stay in close touch on the case. What Mills had found was a very moderate, very slight level of alcohol in Mary Jo Kopechne's blood. The kind of thing anyone would have with a couple of drinks before dinner and maybe a highball afterwards. Mills refused to reveal the test figure. Pressed by reporters about the lack of an autopsy, Mills said he had not done one because it was an open and shut thing, a clear case of death by drowning. There were no bruises, no marks, no kinds of injuries, no nothing. In 15 years as associate medical examiner, Mills had handled 6 cases of accidental drowning. In none of them, he said, had an autopsy been performed. Arena left for the regular session of Edgartown District Court at 10 a.m. A crowd of photographers, reporters, and interested spectators followed him to the police station, where he obtained a complaint application, then back to the courthouse. It was a scene worthy of Cecil B. DeMille, the Vineyard Gazette observed, marking the occasion as the great event. Under television lights, Arena presented court clerk Tommy Teller with papers seeking authorization to issue a complaint against Senator Kennedy. Arena was advised the senator's request for a hearing had been filed by Dick McCarran at 8:30 a.m. Teller scheduled the hearing for Monday, July 28th, at which time he would hear evidence to determine whether police had probable cause to prosecute Kennedy on the charge. The hearing was no different from the 4 or 5 misdemeanor cases he conducted every week. Teller had 2 choices: deny Arena's application or issue the complaint and set a trial date. Arena emerged from the courthouse to confront 2 dozen reporters for an impromptu press conference on the courthouse steps. That he was seeking to prosecute Senator Kennedy had brought him considerable criticism, Arena said. Some people feel I've gone too far. Others think I haven't gone far enough. The emotions surrounding this case have resulted in a personal situation where I'm damned if I do and damned if I don't. Arena had received many telephone calls and telegrams urging him not to yield to political pressures to drop charges in the case, he said. There has not been one single iota of pressure from the Kennedy family or anyone else. With any man of stature, in a case like this, the pressure is on the police department. But to me, this is a case of leaving the scene of an accident, period. I'm treating it like any other police case. Arena was focusing his prosecution on the time lag in reporting the accident. I may very well be tampering with my own case, but the senator's whereabouts will be his defense. He's going to have to prove where he was between 1 a.m. and 10 a.m. Arena wanted to look more closely at the circumstances surrounding a party Senator Kennedy and Mary Jo Kopechne had attended prior to the accident. There's been a lot of hearsay and a lot of talk. As a result, I have requested the assistance of Lieutenant George Killen of the District Attorney's Office to talk to Joseph Gargan, who rented the house at which the party was held, in order to ascertain if the senator was there. Arena wanted Killen to find out whether and how much the senator had been drinking. Arena emphasized he had no evidence the senator had been intoxicated at the time of the accident. Many questions remained unanswered. Who had driven Kennedy from the party the second time? How had the senator returned to Edgartown after the ferry made its last run? And did his friends at the party know about the accident and Mary Jo Kopechne's death before they were reported to the police? Arena disclosed a witness had seen a car similar to the one Senator Kennedy was driving near the accident scene at 12:45 a.m., and that the car looked lost. Arena declined to identify the witness, but he was no match for reporters covering the same ground with the breadth of investigative resourcefulness his small department could not equal. Almost immediately, accounts identified Deputy Sheriff Look as having seen a car whose driver appeared confused at an intersection on Chappaquiddick. But Look's story was being challenged by Arthur Egan of the Manchester Union Leader. The conservative New Hampshire newspaper, unsympathetic to the Kennedy family, called on Monday morning, July 21st, 1969, for Senator Kennedy to resign because of an accident in which a married man was driving a young secretary around the countryside at midnight. In that front page editorial, publisher William Loeb demanded to know, had you been drinking, and was that the reason why you drove off the road into the pond? How much of a daze could Kennedy have been in to be able to find his way back to the cottage, but not think about calling police to see if the girl's life could still be saved? Loeb charged. Senator, do you really think you are really fit to sit in the United States Senate? Don't you think you ought to resign immediately?
County Prosecutor Walter Steele had been puzzled by the discrepancy of the two accounts. At first, he believed Look's story to be accurate. Steele now accepted Kennedy's accident time. Investigation had completely discounted anything Look has said, Steele told reporters Monday afternoon. In his opinion, Look was just seeking a little publicity on a big story. Angered by Steele's remarks, Look replied, "I know what I saw. I saw that car, and saw that L in two digits. My memory's too short to lie."
Arena's request to the district attorney's office for assistance was to make plain that the investigation of the case had been pursued as far as possible by local authorities, Steele said. Although Arena said his investigation was over, it was in fact just beginning. The chief would say later, "Once Kennedy applied for a hearing, I thought, we better get our fannies going and talk to people." There hadn't been much investigating up to that point.
Arena's announcement that the district attorney's office had entered the Kennedy accident case brought reporters to Edmund Denise's second-floor law offices and the two-room district attorney's suite at Bristol County Superior Courthouse in New Bedford, 30 air miles across Buzzards Bay from Edgartown, or 2.5 hours distant by car and ferry. Unprepared for the assault, Denise was, nevertheless, assured and poised meeting the press. Remarkably handsome, there was about him the florid and Latin good looks of an opera singer, with temperament and sonorous baritone to match. Arena's request was the first time Edgartown police had asked his office for help in an investigation, Denise explained. "Tremendous pressure has built up, not from the Kennedy family, but from public opinion. Chief Arena felt he could handle this, but then, because of these pressures, and the extreme interest both locally and nationally, he asked that we enter to help him." Denise described Arena as an extremely capable police officer. Denise used the occasion to defend himself from criticism beginning to surface about his lack of activity in the case. "Some members of the press get irritable, because they believe all I have to do is wave a magic wand, and everyone concerned with this incident will talk. But those close to it are extremely reluctant to talk," Denise said, a veiled reference to the impenetrable silence surrounding the Kennedy compound. "The investigation would take some time, but I assure you it will be thorough and will produce all facts surrounding this unfortunate incident." So clear and unequivocal an assurance that the district attorney's office had entered the case had hardly a chance to draw reaction before Denise retracted it. He denied his office had decided what, if any, action to take in the Kennedy accident. "Until we have more information from law enforcement officers," Denise said, "we can make no decision." Killen hit the ceiling when Denise reported Arena's courthouse remarks. Arena had asked him as a personal favor to talk to Gargan, and maybe some other people on Cape Cod who might have attended the party at Chappaquiddick. Killen hadn't committed the district attorney's office to an investigation. He had no intention of talking to anybody. "It's not our case. We don't have to get involved," Killen told Denise. If all Arena was prepared to go after was a misdemeanor traffic charge, he doesn't need our help. All he's got is an automobile accident without conviction. Let him get a complaint from the district court. Bernie Flynn was unhappy with Killen's tactics. George was telling Arena, yeah, but he wasn't going to do anything. "That's why I felt uncomfortable, because we'd been over there, but we're not really investigating. It's like window dressing to protect the office." Killen was leaving Arena to flounder ineffectually on an investigation that was beyond his capacity to deal with. "I think he had something to do with public relations during the crime commission, like a publicity man for the state police giving out stories," Flynn said. "I like the guy, but he's no detective." Flynn also observed a certain ambivalence on the part of the police chief about surrendering the case to the DA's office. "Positively not. He liked it. He was enjoying all the attention." But Killen was keeping his foot on the brake regarding involvement of the district attorney's office, Flynn noticed. George was on the phone with Denise 3-4 times a day. It was strictly hands-off. Denise was also on the phone to Jimmy Smith. "Did you deliver the message?" Denise asked.
Smith said he hadn't.
Okay, Denise said.
Smith confided to Killen the message Denise had wanted delivered to Ted Kennedy as an indication Denise was sincere in not wanting anything to do with the case. Kennedy's political career depended on more facts about the accident coming out, Killen said. The compound was swarming with advisors and speechwriters. Something was bound to break soon. Ted Kennedy would issue a statement to clear up all the questions about the accident, Killen said.
Let him explain it, and let us stay the hell out of the case.
That was exactly what Smith thought should be done, and the sooner the better, he told Paul Kirk. The silence from the compound was confounding. The longer it went on, the more sinister the situation looked.
It was a serious mistake to stall for time, Smith said. What are they doing over there? What's holding them up?
Kirk didn't know what was going on. Kenneth O'Donnell had yet to be called. Smith thought Ted Kennedy should hold a press conference and open himself up to questions. That was the Kennedy style of confrontation politics, not hiding behind a wall of advisors.
What did they think he could do? Leave a statement and just walk away? Smith said. They've got to move on this thing before it snowballs.
Denise was waiting for some kind of signal to come through about his hands-off position on the case. Denise was loath to do anything for now, but that could change. The press was building up a huge beef against the district attorney's office for inaction. If something didn't come out of the compound soon, the press was going to blow the lid off the case. Then Denise would have to do something. Smith knew one thing about the district attorney. If he's attacked, Eddie always reacts. Smith had been waiting for immediate clarification of one critical point he expected Ted Kennedy would be anxious to clear up about the accident. What was he doing on Dyke Road, traveling in the opposite direction from the ferry landing? No aspect of Kennedy's police report was under more fire than his purported wrong turn. Even Kennedy loyalists, searching for innocent, understandable reasons Kennedy might have made the detour, conceded, it could not have been a mistake. Nobody in condition to drive a car could confuse a dirt road with a macadam one. Because he had not explained this diversion, the worst possible construction is being put on his lack of frankness here, which was inevitable. Smith's main concern was, everybody's thinking, why is he going down that way for? And there was a logical explanation. All he had to say was, I intended to be on a dirt road, because it was going to bring me to the ferry. That's all Smith wanted to get across to Joe Gargan when he called him. There was a second route to the ferry landing on Chappaquiddick that the senator could use to explain his wrong turn. Smith had grown up in Edgartown. He was familiar with Chappaquiddick. Don't forget the geographical location of that cottage. Cars drive up facing the front of the house. The parking is perpendicular to the road. If you come out in the pitch black and you aren't familiar with the area and pull away from the cottage and take a left on the hard road, then a right on a dirt road, you'll go down to the bridge, Smith told Gargan. But if you back out and take a right from the cottage, go down to the end of the macadam, then take a right on a dirt road, that dirt road brings you to the ferry landing. That would explain why Teddy Kennedy made a right turn off a paved road. It's the same configuration, only he turned wrong at the cottage. He went out, backed up, and instead of going right and left, he went left and right. It's a simple mistake to make. Gargan listened politely to Smith's advisory. He could give no assurances he'd be able to deliver the information or the Denise message Smith asked to be passed along to the councils at the compound. The wrong turn was also bothering the 15 to 20 advisors already assembled at the compound. The senator was sticking to his police statement that he had been heading for the ferry at the time of the accident. Others at the compound were equally uncomfortable with other portions of the senator's story. His reluctance to disclose more details about the accident or release information to an increasingly restless press. Advisors saw what the dangers were in remaining silent and grasped what needed to be done, biographer Burton Hirsch reported later. But nobody was prepared to act without permission from Kennedy and risk his own reputation on the success of the consequences. Kennedy put off any decision at all. I didn't want to set up any kind of discussion with the funeral coming up, the grief of the family, he said.
Dr. Watt observed the senator's condition was unchanged when he examined him on Monday afternoon. Kennedy continued to have pain and stiffness in his neck, aggravated by activity and turning his head. Watt recommended x-rays be taken. Kennedy was driven to Cape Cod Hospital by his father's nurse, John Ryan. He underwent a standard four-position series and exposure of the first to seventh vertebrae of the cervical spine. Radiologist W. E. Benjamin found no evidence of fracture or depression. The marked straightening of the spine in the lateral projection indicated a rather marked muscle spasm. Watt had Kennedy fitted with an orthopedic collar and contacted Dr. Milton Broom, chief of neurosurgery at Cape Cod Hospital, for a consultation. Kennedy complained of a stiff neck, lower back pain, and a generalized headache, but was alert, oriented, his speech and vision normal when Broom examined him. In describing the accident to the doctor, Kennedy remembered driving down a road and had some recollection of the car striking a beam along the side of the bridge, but he remembered nothing of any impact against water or the car turning over. A gap in his memory, of indeterminable length but presumably brief, Broom noted. His next recollection is of being in the front seat of his car, which was filling with water. He somehow escaped from the car, but does not know how he did this. He states further that he can recall making repeated efforts to get back to the car by diving. Subsequent events are recalled in a somewhat fragmentary fashion, with an impaired recall of their exact time relationships. Broom diagnosed cervical concussion, contusion and abrasion of the scalp, and acute cervical strain. He recommended an electroencephalogram. Kennedy was in a tense and waking state during the test, which revealed no abnormalities to Dr. Robert Feldman of the Boston Neurological Laboratory. That finding appeared to call into judgment the symptoms of memory loss, impairment of judgment, and confused behavior which Dr. Watt had reported. Any neurological symptoms or alternations of awareness, levels of consciousness or memory, would show up on an EEG, according to medical authorities consulted by the Boston Globe. It is safe to be dubious about the contention that there was a protracted period when Kennedy was alternately lucid and then terribly confused, because this behavior would almost certainly show up if the EEG had been properly administered and interpreted. Dr. Watt recommended the senator not attend Mary Jo Kopechne's funeral scheduled for the next day. Kennedy hoped to go, barring any medical reason, Press Secretary Dick Drane announced in Washington. He's still under a doctor's care, and the doctor's opinion would have to be considered. The senator intended to give no further explanation of the accident, Drane said. As of this moment, there are no specific plans for either a statement or a news conference. Gargan recalled a lot of different discussions and arrangements about the funeral. There was no question Gargan was going. He left Hyannisport on Monday afternoon for Boston and a pre-flight meeting with his lawyer, Joe Donahue, at Logan Airport. Gargan related the events of the accident at Chappaquiddick to Donahue, he said. I told him the whole story, absolutely everything, including Ted's resistance to reporting the accident and his failure to do so, in the expectation Gargan would come around to the scheme he'd proposed to avoid involvement. Donahue wasn't impressed with the seriousness of the case. He kind of brushed it off as not as excitable as some people were making it out to be, Gargan said. His reaction was that I had very little liability to be concerned about. Donahue said he would be available any time Gargan wanted to discuss the case. In his 80s and in semi-retirement, Donahue suggested Gargan rely on his son, Joe Jr., a lawyer in the family law firm who had accompanied his father to the meeting. He told Gargan, "Dad is getting older now, and this isn't something he should get involved with." But recapitulating the events of the accident had renewed the outrage Gargan had suffered at the Chappaquiddick landing, when the senator bolted from the car with a promise to report the accident. To Gargan, Teddy's attempt to conceal the accident, his childlike dread of facing the consequences of Mary Jo Kopechne's death, had betrayed an astonishing weakness of character. On the other hand, Gargan had done nothing to be ashamed of. He'd gotten into the water, as treacherous as that effort had been, and as hopeless as he knew the situation to be.
He hadn't sat on his ass on the bridge feeling sorry for himself, and refused to take responsibility for what he'd done. And he did not attempt to conceal the accident from authorities, then invoke lawyer-client privilege to prevent anybody from finding out. The renewal of a Lowell connection revived in Gargan a renascent pride of place and family. "Gargans don't shit in their own bed," he said. And that guy drove a car off a bridge and put everybody in the soup. Chapter 20. The journey to Wilkes Barre was a sad occasion for Gargan, who was particularly anxious to pay his respects to Mary Jo's parents. Gargan introduced himself to the couple, and I described what had happened. And I indicated in some way that I had done everything possible to save Mary Jo, saying that I was sorry I couldn't do more. But in the sadness of the moment, I don't think they understood much of what I said, that I had been at Chappaquiddick, or that I was the person at whose house Mary Jo had visited the year before. I understood that, of course. I'd lost a lot of my own family myself. They were terribly shocked by this whole thing, and I don't think they knew who I was. Gargan exchanged greetings with the boiler room girls. I didn't have a discussion with them about the accident or anything else. Gargan was present strictly as a mourner. He was not advancing the funeral in anticipation of the senator's arrival. That responsibility had fallen to Dunn Gifford. Gifford had returned to Wilkes Barre on Monday afternoon. Reporters spotted him and several boiler room girls having a drink in the bar of the Holiday Inn. At their approach, the group got up and walked into a coffee shop. It was difficult to remain silent about the accident beyond the cloister of Hyannisport, and at the same time maintain requisite good relations with the press. Gifford passed word to reporters that a doctor recommended against the senator coming to the funeral. Asked if that meant Kennedy wasn't planning to attend, Gifford backed off, trying to convey how desperately anxious the senator was to pay his respects. Gifford quoted a Kennedy family friend who said, "He'd come if he were unconscious." To his assignment to prepare the Kopechnys for Kennedy's appearance at the funeral and protect them as well as he could from reporters, Gifford brought a subtlety of purpose and consideration which won praise from Joseph Kopechny. "Dunn Gifford was very kind and generous. He helped us a lot. He let us answer our phone. He never made any suggestions one way or another as to how we should handle ourselves. You have to respect somebody like that, because he was a Kennedy man." But Gifford could render only moral support. He had nothing to tell the Kopechnys about the accident which had killed their daughter. Messages of condolence were pouring into the Kielty funeral home from all over the country. Kopechny revealed, "The first one we got was a newspaper clipping of Senator Kennedy. The sender had drawn a noose around his neck and written, 'This is what should happen to him.' These letters, they're all directed at Kennedy, but they're hurting us." Senator Kennedy had telephoned again on Monday afternoon. "I still couldn't understand him. I could see he was trying to tell us about the accident, but he was still so broken up he couldn't talk." Kopechny didn't think the senator would attend the funeral, because he was in such bad condition mentally. But the senator had other plans. Senator Kennedy departed from Barnstable County Airport before 7 a.m. on Tuesday morning on the private DC-3 owned by the Great Lakes Carbon Corporation, an enterprise of Ethel Kennedy's family. He wore a dark blue suit. A black tie was loosely knotted around a dress shirt open to accommodate a cervical collar. On board was his wife Joan, Congressman John Tunney of California, and John Culver of Iowa, Administrative aide David Burke, and Massachusetts Democratic Committee chairman David Harrison. Harrison announced to a corps of reporters waiting at Scranton Wilkes-Barre Airport that Senator Kennedy expected to issue a statement within the next few days to explain what he had done during more than 9 hours following the automobile accident in which Mary Jo Kopechny was killed. The Kennedy party was driven in two cars to Plymouth, a town of 10,000 in the center of Pennsylvania's coal mining region. Kennedy was met at the rectory of St. Vincent's Roman Catholic Church by Monsignor William Burchill and his curate. A parish secretary observed the senator to be uncomfortable because of the neck brace he was wearing. It was very difficult for him to even talk and walk, she said. He looks like he's had a bad time.
The senator's appearance had turned a somber ceremonial occasion into a political celebration. An excited, curious crowd was spilling out into the street outside the elaborate red brick church by the time the Kopechnys arrived, in a car that stopped behind the funeral home's hearse.
They wanted to see the Kennedys. I understood that, Joseph Kopechny commented.
Nothing that big has happened around here since 34 settlers were killed by Indians, and that was before the Revolutionary War.
The TV crews and the burst of flashbulbs frightened Gwen Kopechny.
I'd seen so many people and their sadness on television, she said later. I didn't want to see myself that way.
A small, dark-haired woman, Mrs. Kopechny was wearing sunglasses and a black linen dress. She was near collapse when Don Gifford assisted her from the car. The Kopechnys met Senator Kennedy in the rectory's shade-drawn front parlor. The priests withdrew after introductions were made. The conversation was private, Gifford said. The accident was not discussed.
Kennedy was talking, and I still couldn't understand a word he said. He was so emotional, Joseph Kopechny said. I think he really sacrificed a lot coming to the funeral, the way he was feeling.
The funeral party entered a side door of the church leading to the sacristy. Kennedy's appearance provoked an excited murmur of recognition from more than 500 spectators filling the church, most of them women. Mrs. Kopechny wept inconsolably during a low requiem mass, celebrated in an oppressive heat that permeated the large, ornately decorated church. Gargan stood at the back, apart from the fourth-row pew the Kennedy party occupied. The senator was a mask of anguish when he walked past the bronze casket to receive communion. The Kopechnys followed the casket out of the front door of the church. The senator was delayed by women reaching out to touch him. He nodded to well-wishers but said nothing. He left by a door near the altar. Shouts of, "There he is," greeted Kennedy's appearance at the front of the church. Photographers held cameras over their heads to take pictures. Above the tumult, the voice of Mayor Walter Burns could be heard, shouting, "Okay, you spectators, move back! Move back!" Kennedy was visibly distressed by the implacable curiosity of the crowd. His wife attempted to smile at those pushing and jostling for a closer look at the famous couple. Kennedy said to her, "Let's get to the car." Police locked arms to hold back the throng as Kennedy was guided to a white sedan. It took 10 minutes for a 25-car cortege to form. State police had to clear a lane on the winding mountain road leading to the parish cemetery in Larksville, made impassable by cars parked on both sides, to catch a glimpse of the Kennedy party as it went by. Spectators gathered on lawns and front porches along the route, some with cameras. A spattering of applause occasionally punctuated the procession, as if it were a parade. The Kopechnys sat on folding chairs beneath a canopy at the graveside. Kennedy stood in the rear, staring distractedly at the surrounding green mountains scarred by slag heaps. The funeral over, he attended a post-funeral buffet. "We had a great time at lunch," Kopechny recalled. "It was like one big family. I embarrassed him, I think. I called my nephew over, and I said to Kennedy, 'Here's a good Democrat.' The senator took it beautifully. He laughed. He said to me, 'You're really something.'" When Kopechny spoke to Ethel Kennedy, "I thought I was talking to my sister. That's the way she makes you feel. She's like that nice lady next door. She was interested in what was being done about safety in the mines. She asked all about the area." Gwen Kopechny was working automatically to greet people. "I don't remember that I talked to anybody. I was under medication that let me forget all the things I didn't want to remember. I wasn't ever to the funeral. I don't remember any of it." "She was in an absolute daze," Kopechny confirmed. No additional information about the death of their daughter had been disclosed to the Kopechnys by Senator Kennedy or the Boiler Room Girls. The young women had burst into tears at the funeral home, on first viewing Mary Jo, reposed in an open coffin and dressed in a blue peignoir. Her hands clasped a crystal rosary.
A bouquet of yellow roses sent by Senator and Mrs. Kennedy stood on a pedestal, separate from other floral tributes. The young women did not discuss the accident among themselves in view of a gathering furor of speculation about the party at Chappaquiddick. Esther Newberg said, "We all talked at Wilkes Barre at Mary Jo's funeral. We said, let people think whatever they want. Let our friend be buried." Newberg had engaged in a brief conversation with Senator Kennedy. "He asked me how I was. I asked him how he was. He was concerned about my parents and their reaction. I was concerned about his wife." Though out in force, the press kept a respectful distance from the senator, at this his first public appearance since the accident. The senator was further insulated from reporters by a coterie of friends and aides. The funeral provided an opportunity to leak information about the accident, without the formality of an official statement or attribution. This enabled Kennedy's handlers to stir a little sympathy for the senator into the stew of controversy beginning to boil over regarding the silence maintained about the accident for 4 days. Aides confided first indications of what had happened when Kennedy returned dripping wet from the accident to collapse in the back seat of a car parked in front of the cottage, where his friends had been holding a party. Kennedy was able to give them an account of the accident. He could remember thinking, "I'm drowning. This is incredible." He had no idea how he escaped from the submerged car. Aides refused to explain why neither the senator nor his friends reported the accident for more than 9 hours. Said to be drawn and despondent since his return to Hyannisport, the senator conferred with a half-dozen friends and political advisers late Saturday night and early Sunday. Some had counseled him to remain silent about the accident. Kennedy favored a carefully worded explanation, but decided not to make any statement in the foreseeable future about the accident, and might never make one. Chapter 21. The matter of a statement was more aggressively pursued when the senator landed at Hyannis Airport around 2:15 p.m. Kennedy looked pained to be greeted by a cluster of reporters clamoring for comment. Kennedy turned away from the first confrontation with reporters since the accident. "This is the day of the funeral," he said. "This isn't the appropriate time. But I will make a full statement at the appropriate time." He then walked determinedly away from trailing reporters. The most aggressive in pursuit was Liz Trotta of NBC News. "There has been some question as to what effect this will have on your political career," she said. Kennedy whirled about in anger to confront his inquisitor. "I've just come from the funeral of a very lovely young lady, and this is not the appropriate time for such questions," he said indignantly. "I am not going to have any other comment to make." Kennedy got into the front seat of a white car bearing Massachusetts license plates USS-1, his wife at the wheel, and was driven away. Almost at once, sources close to Kennedy denied the senator had any immediate plans for a statement. His remarks at the airport had been intended only to pacify the press. Kennedy's return to Hyannisport was preceded by the arrival of his brother-in-law, Stephen Smith. Manager of the Kennedy family fortune and dispenser of campaign monies, Smith was the mysterious éminence grise who had always been associated with Kennedy invincibility. A backroom specialist with the capacity to move into almost any situation with an abbreviated quick deadliness. Smith was dismayed by the scene he found in Hyannisport. Half the press of the world was standing outside in the street. Those guys acted like it was the 5 p.m. express. Christ! There were telephones all over the goddamn place. If this had been anybody but Edward Kennedy, we wouldn't have gotten the attention. Smith found conditions inside the compound no better. The ongoing councils were fragmented, without focus. The senator so self-absorbed as to be a non-participant. There were mutterings of discontent among the senator's staff about the interference of outsiders, most of them former equerries of his brothers, Jack and Bobby. Smith took charge of what was proving to be the prickliest crisis in the history of the Kennedy family. Burke Marshall had put off his departure to attend a terminally ill father until Smith could take over. The elevated lawyerly arts that Marshall practiced
were inapplicable on so low a rung of the legal ladder as an auto accident. Smith conferred with Edward Hanafy about the senator's liability in the accident. Our prime concern was whether or not the guy survived the thing, whether he wrote out the still possible charge of manslaughter, he said later. To assist Richard McCarran to defend the traffic complaint, and whatever other charges might result from the accident, Hanafy suggested former District Court Judge Robert Clark of Brockton. The preeminent motor vehicles specialist in Massachusetts, Clark had a summer house on Cape Cod. Although the compound was already well populated with advisors, Smith called in reinforcements of his own, principally Ted Sorensen, the rhetorician of the New Frontier. Former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara was on his way from a rented house on Martha's Vineyard. His arrival at the compound to inspire the most widely quoted jibe of the episode. "Well, Bob, you handled the Bay of Pigs in Vietnam. Now let's see what you can do with this one." Gargan recognized who was in charge when he got back to Hyannisport. Steve's attitude was kind of organizing everything that was trying to help Ted, and whatever was going to happen. I never did talk to him about the accident. Directly, he did not get involved with me as to the factual details. What the senator did, what I did, he left that pretty much up to the lawyers. If Ted Kennedy was going to tell anyone about his behavior at the landing at Chappaquiddick, and his delay in reporting the accident, that person would be Stephen Smith. Smith would have to know the whole truth to make sure Ted Kennedy was protected. Gargan was following Hanafy's orders not to disclose anything about the post-accident advice he had given Ted Kennedy. But he didn't require the muzzle of lawyer-client privilege to keep quiet. Bonds of friendship, family ties, and his real concern for the legal bind Kennedy was in were sufficient to guarantee silence. Gargan had no intention of betraying Kennedy's craven behavior at the landing to anyone. Concerned that Gargan had become the focus of a new investigation undertaken by the district attorney's office grew when it was learned that Detective Lieutenant George Killen had been asked specifically by Police Chief Arena to question Gargan about the party at Chappaquiddick. As it happened, their concern was groundless. "I never heard from Killen or Arena," Gargan disclosed. "They never came near me." Chapter 22. While the compound was holding the press at arm's length, Arena decided to hold twice daily news briefings, beginning on Tuesday. It was the only way the chief could hope to get on with his investigation and also meet the rising demands of the press, Walter Steele said. Unless we closed the police station. By now, Chappaquiddick had burgeoned from a routine automobile case into a scandal tantalized into prominence by the inexplicable gaps in the senator's delayed report, the baffling silence from the Kennedy compound, and an inept and barely launched police investigation. Edgartown was suffering an invasion of reporters, photographers, major TV commentators and camera crews, the likes of which it had never seen before, local newsman Harvey Ewing observed. Everyone was flying in media people. The number of press swelled to an incredible 450 within a couple of days. They beat the tourist mob any day. The place got to be a zoo very quickly. The Vineyard Gazette added that the Kennedy accident was turning into a story about getting the story. Never on the island had a single incident been the inspiration of so many individual investigations. The digging for facts that began on Saturday has continued unabated since. The world, it seems, wants to know more than the fact that there was a tragic accident. Pressure was applied mostly on Arena. "I left Boston to get away from all this commotion," he said before his first briefing. "Look at what I've got now. There are 50 million policemen saying, 'Thank God it's not me investigating this case.'" At 10 a.m. on Tuesday, July 22nd, Arena faced reporters for the first of a series of formal and controversial briefings. In a plain room in the Federated Church Parish House, normally used for church suppers and Sunday school, hastily improvised for the purpose. The room was furnished with mismatched wooden desk chairs, a locked upright piano, and a framed mezzo tint of Jesus Christ in the garden at Gethsemane.
Arena presided behind a folding table. Walter Steele sat beside him to provide legal advice. If Arena was the genial host for the proceedings, full of smiles and boundless goodwill, Steele was physically missing.